Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, the smoke is still kind of clearing as we learn exactly what was in the debt ceiling compromise, as more people already start focusing on what, in fact, this Uber committee, as you put it yesterday, will be actually accomplishing over the next couple of months. In the meantime, of course, we have another standoff over the FAA. None of that, of course, is exactly our first martini, but the aftermath of the debt ceiling is in one way, because one of our favorite people, Marco Rubio, the new Republican senator from Florida, took to the Senate floor in the wake of the debate and explained that, yes, we may have extended the debt ceiling, and many people think that was a crisis averted, but he's pointing out very rightly that there is another crisis coming that probably can't unless we change course very quickly.
We will one day reach a day in this country where we will face a debt crisis, but it won't be because of the debt limit or because of gridlock in Washington. It will be because folks are no longer willing to buy America's debt because they seriously doubt our ability to pay it back. It's not hyperbole. It's not an exaggeration. It is a mathematical, indisputable fact that no member of either party would dispute.
And, of course, as we see on various websites today, Jim, now that the debt ceiling has been extended, the U.S. is borrowing like crazy, tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars in the wake of that move. So I think that lends even more credibility to the point that Rubio is making here, is that a lot of people think we'll never be Greece, but if we don't change course, eventually we'll get there, just on a much larger scale.
Yeah, and I think one of the things is the more you look at this deal, it's not as great as the proponents say it is. It's not as bad as everybody who's weeping and wailing over it. I think Rubio's perspective is right, which is that, look, this is act one of a you know, at least a three-act play, and maybe, you know, many acts in this play. Maybe it's a one chapter of a long book. So there will be many more opportunities to try to, you know, get the debt under control and to have probably some very, very tough fights over spending and you know, priorities. Another quote I wanted to share with you, just because I came across it as you were talking about this as a possible good martini. Alan West, one of our other favorite folks, a guy who supported the Boehner deal and who kind of was, you know, surprising some folks, said when he was speaking to a group of young Republicans, Republicans should come up with what he calls a 70 to 75% plan. Because if you sit around trying to come up with a 100% plan, while you're doing that, the enemy has already attacked you and run through you. And I think that's, you know, a good argument of playing the long game, that a lot of people in Washington are really obsessed with winning the news cycle or the next day's headlines or short-term stuff. And if fiscal conservatives really kind of try to take a long-term approach and get a good chunk of what they want, but not needing everything they want in each step of this process, then bit by bit by bit, they will get what they want in the long-term perspective. We got to remember that the big spenders and the folks on the other side of the aisle and liberals did not change the country overnight to get what they want. They chipped away at it day by day. And I think that's really the only approach that will work for conservatives in the long term.
And just to clarify, us approaching the cliff is not the good martini. It's that Marco Rubio is a very eloquent communicator in explaining the danger of us getting close to the cliff. And fortunately, we have more and more of those as a result of the most recent midterm election. So on to the bad martini now. And Jim, I believe it was just yesterday we were celebrating the fact, really, that as horrible as the president's lack of leadership was on the debt ceiling debate, it did keep him away from about 10 fundraisers, at least between him and Joe Biden combined. So the president's a little bit behind where he was hoping to be on the fundraising total. And I threw in there as an aside, well, fear not, whenever he does make some of those fundraising trips and campaign trips, I'm sure he'll all find a way to put a town hall on the calendar to make sure everybody pays for it. Well, we didn't have to wait long.
Hello world, hear the song.
Jim, the Obama bus tour just happening to go through critical states that will be vital for the electoral map. He's starting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, home of the Scranton Scrapper, Joe Biden himself, making his way all the way through the Midwest, beneath the Great Lakes, up to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And yes, of course, it's all on the taxpayer dime, because I'm sure he's doing some sort of quote-unquote official business. But as you pointed out yesterday, his official business and the campaign rallies are really kind of indistinguishable at this point.
What an amazing coincidence that everywhere the president feels the need to go to talk about the job circumstance just happens to coincide with swing states in 2012. Boy, Greg, what are the odds? You know, the irony is that we've seen Lots of presidents have always done the, well, I'll do a campaign fundraiser and I'll do a, you know, official event on the same trip, so that way taxpayers cover half the expenses. Okay, that's, you know, that's standard. We've also seen lots of bus tours before. Earlier this year, Palin did one. We've seen bus tours. I remember Clinton and Gore in the summer of 1992, et cetera.
Yep.
So bus tours aren't unusual. But seeing the taxpayers pay for half of a bus tour feels like we're breaking through some new barrier. And I guess, you know, Obama gets to use one of his favorite words again, unprecedented. Now, we were thinking about this, and I salute you for the fantastic musical selection of that. I'm sure Get Happy is going to be about as effective as every other jobs message he has. I mean, it really should be called a lack of jobs tour. But whenever I think of this, I actually was reminded of another famous bus. I was reminded of the movie Speed. And I just wanted to picture Keanu Reeves yelling, "There's a bombing president on the bus! There's a bombing message! Get off the bus!"
And he's got to keep
unemployment goes below 5.5. Anyway, so
that's right. Yeah, this is kind of pathetic. I guess this is part of his ongoing balanced approach, where the American people pay for half, and his campaign pays for half, regardless of the fact that and almost the entirety of it is his campaign, which he should be paying for the entirety of. But hopefully, he sees what the gas prices are in some of these states while he's on the road. And finds out exactly how many people are out of work, thanks to the fact that he really hasn't had a cohesive jobs plan anywhere along the way, except spending more money, which, surprise, surprise, didn't work. So hopefully those are the lessons.
I think, Greg, it might be smarter for him just to use a corporate jet. Of course, to get to these things, where he can denounce corporate jet owners and ATMs and all of that.
You mentioned Al Gore, as Clinton and Gore did a bus tour back in the summer of 92, and they were feeling America's pain and keeping hope alive, or whatever it was they were doing. Believing in a place called hope, I think, is what they were doing. Anyway, Al Gore, of course, runs Current TV, and one of his newest hires is Keith Olbermann, who apparently, I know this is going to shock a lot of people, had a pretty incendiary special comment on his show the other night in the wake of the debt ceiling deal. And so the boss came on, Al Gore, to make a suggestion for what the American people should do. Jim, you're going to love this one.
We need to have an American spring. You know, the Arab Spring, the nonviolent part of it, isn't finished yet. But we need to have an American spring, a kind of an American Tahrir Square, nonviolent change.
Well, that could be twisted in a lot of different ways. First of all, things in Egypt haven't actually turned out so well. You've got a lot of crackdowns going on in other places. But here's my favorite part, because at least Al Gore recognizes the fact that, you know what, there has been a movement in recent years about people who are fed up with the way things are in Washington. Imagine that. But that's not a real movement, because that's a manufactured. Here we go.
But that movement was funded with seed money from right-wing billionaires, the Koch brothers, and promoted on Fox News, and turned into a stalking horse for this right-wing agenda that a lot of people have been trying to push on this country for a long time. Mm-hmm.
So all these people were gathering by the hundreds and thousands in places all across the country because of the Koch brothers, who I would guess the majority haven't even heard of. So clearly Al Gore's got his finger on the pulse on this one.
Greg, I've been to a couple of these tea parties. Did you get your Koch check yet?
Not yet.
I keep hearing this from liberals that we're all AstroTurf, that we're all in it for the money, and maybe mine's lost in the middle. Look, I thought the whole reason we were joining this side is that we were the well-funded one and all that stuff. It's in light of that, because the checks haven't come and nobody else I've spoke to has gotten theirs, it's almost like people are doing it because they really believe it, like it's a genuine passion or something. We know that can't be true, because, you know, I think it was Barbara Boxer who said people dress too nicely to be genuine, you know, protesters. Apparently, judging us by our attire, we should be wearing your rags and such to be an authentic movement. When I saw that he was talking about American Spring, I almost wondered if this was going to be, you know, tied into global warming or something. And I have to salute Al Gore for being someone who can take perfectly, not even legitimate points, but there is an argument to be said of, like, you know, all right, you know, liberals, we've got to get moving out here. And he uses a comparison of protests against autocrats like Mubarak or Bashar Assad.
Right.
And by the way, if he wants to say the leader of this country is like Bashar Assad, I suppose we could kind of laugh at that. But really, actually, wouldn't that even kind of offend you, Greg?
Probably.
I mean, Bashar Assad is like blowing up a city in northern Syria right now. And even on the very worst of days, we wouldn't accuse Obama of that. So But I guess apparently the Speaker of the House is like Mubarak or something, or I don't know. The whole metaphor just doesn't work. And this is Al Gore. I mean, it's not just enough for him to say, I'm worried about climate change. It's got to be, we're all going to die in 10 years. It's not just got to be, you know, I disagree with the Bush's rhetoric. It's got to be, he played on our fears. You know, it's kind of like he internalized the criticism of Al Gore being a boring guy. It was around Washington all throughout the 80s and 90s. I remember the great Dennis Miller joke, or his Jay Leno joke, that Al Gore's personalized license plate is a random series of letters and numbers. and then, so as a result of that, he's decided to be interesting, and I'm making air quotes as I do that, by being the most rabidly hyperbolic, over-the-top person he can be. And I just think he's in the process unhinged. You know, he's like, I don't even say bipolar would be the right thing, but he's either droning on endlessly, or he's, you know, frothing at the mouth and making these ludicrous comparisons that I'm unconvinced, but I'm just glad we can keep him on a network nobody's watching instead of, you know, him getting out to some place that people might actually see him, even like, by comparison, MSNBC. Mark it, the one and only time I'll say something nice about MSNBC, saying that they're probably, you know, crushing current in the ratings.
I would just once again like to thank Catherine Harris. I'd like to thank the five justices of the United States Supreme Court and the voters of Florida who actually did vote more for George W. Bush than Al Gore in 2000. Because thankfully, thanks to all of you, as well as those who he carried in other states, we didn't have to deal with President Al Gore. That was frighteningly close, given what he's been saying recently. So thanks again for what you did 10 years ago. We appreciate it.
You know, Al Gore wants an American spring. Since he's an environmentalist, maybe he'll get one of those silent springs he keeps going on about.
Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.